Good evening, everyone. I'm Kyle Kick, Executive Director of Be Strong Together, and I'd like to thank you for joining us for tonight's presentation. A little housekeeping before we get started. We will be recording the presentation, so your camera and audio will remain off during the program. If you have any questions that you would like to submit, please feel free to send it in the chat. We've had many questions on this important topic submitted during registration, but don't worry, we're planning to follow up with our experts for additional videos where we can ask some of the questions that we don't get to tonight. About 6 weeks ago, I was approached by a Barrington mother who was concerned about the way that her middle school son was talking about his body. She had been hearing more and more about parents who were worried about their child's eating or exercise habits, their views about their bodies and their relationship with food. She was wondering if Be Strong Together would be able to put together a program to answer some of these issues. There's been a rise in disordered eating and eating disorders among the youth in our community and others across the country, leaving families, educators, and community members seeking resources, answers, and support. We reached out to some of our wonderful partners and are joined tonight by an incredible panel of local experts who will discuss what they're seeing in their practices, what parents, educators, and others need to know about disordered eating, and how to seek help if you're concerned about someone you love. Thank you to everyone who submitted questions for tonight's presentation. As I said, we hope to answer as many of your questions as possible through the presentations and our Q&A session following. Please feel free to submit additional questions through the chat as they come up, and we'll try to provide answers either tonight or in follow-up videos. With that said, I would like to begin by introducing our wonderful panel of experts. Dr. Lacey Lemke is a licensed clinical psychologist specializing in the treatment of eating disorders and medical and health psychology. She serves as the service line director of the Amita Center for Eating Disorders at Amita Alexian Brothers Behavioral Health Hospital in Hoffman Estates. Dr. Melissa Lutz is a postdoctoral fellow at the Center for Eating Disorders who works supporting patients and families in treatment. Asiya Roman is a registered dietitian at the Center for Eating Disorders and the founder and head dietitian of Diet RD Nutrition Unlimited in Hoffman Estates. She specializes in eating disorders, pediatric and family nutrition, wellness, intolerances, and weight management. And Christina Fitzgerald is a registered dietitian, board certified sports dietitian, and a founder and owner of Fitzgerald Nutrition in Barrington. She specializes in disordered eating, eating disorder recovery, hypothalamic amenorrhea, which I've been practicing how to say a lot today, and sports nutrition. Both Asiya and Christina are also District 220 moms. Dr. Lemke, if you can begin just by giving us some information about eating disorders and disordered eating to start off our conversation.
Absolutely. Hello, everybody. I'm so excited to be here, as I know the other panelists are. I'm going to be sharing my screen. So a PowerPoint should show on your screen. Hope it works nicely. All right. Perfect. Great. Okay. So this evening, I thought we would start off with some eating disorder statistics, and then we'll move into talking a little bit about some trends that I'm seeing in my programs that I have at Amita. We have an inpatient hospitalization program, as well as PhD and IOP. We also have a medical group feeding service protocol that we offer in our pediatric hospital right next door. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the trends that we're seeing, and then I'll go over briefly the diagnoses within the eating disorder category, so you can familiarize yourself with what those eating disorders might look like presentation-wise. So first, some statistics. Research shows us that eating disorders affect about 30 million Americans within their lifetimes. That's about 9% of the population. Interesting, less than 6% of people with eating disorders are medically diagnosed as underweight. And this is really important because it really shows that often these diagnoses can be missed, right? 28 to 74% of risk for eating disorders is through genetic heritability, which is also very interesting. We'll talk a little bit about that later, but it's not uncommon if someone is struggling with eating disorder tendencies or behaviors, there may be a presence within that genetic line. Eating disorders are among the deadliest mental illness, second only to opioid overdose, which a lot of folks are not familiar with. Every 52 minutes, we lose someone as a direct result of an eating disorder. About 26% of individuals with eating disorders attempt suicide, and the economic cost of eating disorders currently is at about $65 billion a year. So speaking about some trends that we've seen in the programming at AMITA, we certainly have seen, not necessarily surprisingly, but unfortunately, a decrease in age. We're seeing younger populations come through and need services. Now we know from the literature that the earlier we catch this, the better the prognosis, but we are starting to see presentations in young children who need services. Some statistics about our younger population, and I will say that it's important to know that eating disorders do not discriminate and can impact both males and females, and certainly do, but in looking at the research, 42% of first through third grade girls reported wanting to be thinner. 81% of 10-year-old children indicated being afraid of being fat in some of the literature that has recently been put out. When we're looking at 9 to 11-year-olds feeling that they are sometimes or very often on diets, it captures almost half of the individuals studied. And when we look at the literature again, about 35 to 57% of adolescent girls indicated engaging in crash dieting, fasting, compensatory behaviors like self-induced vomiting, use of diet pills, or laxatives. So there is a biological component similar to many mental disorders, but some psychological factors or presentations that you might see within individuals who are struggling with eating disorders might be a strive for perfection, very achievement and goal-oriented. Typically, individuals who are really struggling with feeling in control or on top of things may grasp onto an eating disorder as a way to feel that sense of control in their life. We typically see that these individuals may feel easily overwhelmed, oftentimes inadequate, have difficulty expressing themselves. It's not uncommon for individuals in this population to be very people-pleasing and have a fear of letting folks down. We see a lot of shame in this population about physical appearance or body or even behaviors that they're engaging in. And also troubled relationships. So with eating disorders, we see that oftentimes that impacts the individual's ability to appropriately function. So they're pulling themselves out of engaging with friends, engaging with family, engaging in things that they previously loved, which then pulls them out and then plays a role in the relationships that they have. So a lot of work that we do focuses on that interpersonal functioning and really getting individuals back to life versus leaning into their eating disorder as a way to manage any type of distress. Some truths that I think are really important: many folks with eating disorders may look completely healthy, yet can still be very ill. Eating disorder diagnosis is a health crisis that we and our philosophy at AMITA really focus on as being a family issue. So we take a lot of time and effort in incorporating the entire family into the treatment of eating disorders. Very important to note, eating disorders are not choices. They are serious, biologically influenced illnesses. And I think that is something that's vital for many to know. There is no discrimination when it comes to eating disorders. They affect folks of all genders, ages, race, ethnicity, body shape, sexual orientation, social economic status, you name it. And then obviously, I think something that's really important to note is that full recovery is absolutely possible. Many folks feel like recovery isn't an option, or feel like if someone has an eating disorder, it's going to follow them into their life and be long lasting. But full recovery is possible, and the early detection of eating disorders and our ability to intervene are super important. So quickly, I just want to run through the diagnoses associated with eating disorders. First, we have anorexia nervosa. Presentation in this diagnosis are going to be folks that have an extreme concern with body weight and shape. These folks typically engage in self-starvation or restriction. They have an intense fear of being or feeling quote unquote fat. We see excessive weight loss here, and we see a refusal to maintain 85% of their body weight. So these folks are typically struggling with malnutrition. You're going to see an increase of rigidity, maybe some slow cognition, what once may be a thriving 15-year-old teenager. You're seeing, you know, your straight A student, they might start to struggle with school, not keep up with things, right? These are some typical presentations that might come up when an individual is struggling. Bulimia nervosa, so that also involves extreme concern about body weight and shape. But here's a bit different. We see some repeated episodes of two things. First, binging, which is considered eating far beyond the point of comfortable fullness. An important thing to remember about binge eating is that there is that aspect of a loss of control within that episode, combined with self-compensatory behaviors. So that may be purging, self-induced episodes of vomiting, laxative use, diuretic abuse, excessive exercising. And that's what classifies bulimia nervosa. If you have individuals who do struggle with purging behavior, but their main other struggle is restriction, there's no binging present, we do have classifiers, if you will, or specifiers within our diagnoses for patients who are anorexic and restricting but engaging in that purging behavior. So I want to clarify that. A lot of times people think if they hear about an individual struggling with self-induced vomiting, it's immediately bulimia, not always the case. So that is what a good clinical evaluation will rule out. If binge eating disorder involves uncontrolled, continuous, or impulsive eating, again, beyond the point of being comfortably full, but here we don't see that compensatory behavior. So typically we see binges are followed by a lot of shame and self-hatred. Important to note, body weight can range from very normal to severe obesity. And then we have ARFID, and I love talking about ARFID. I am trying to make sure I'm staying on my 15-minute mark, so I only have about a couple minutes left. But ARFID was just introduced into the DSM, the last publication, and I think a lot of these folks who struggled with this particular criteria were typically and wrongly placed on the spectrum. So signs of ARFID, which stands for Avoidant Restrictive Food Intake Disorder, involves folks having a very short list of acceptable foods. So you're going to see people who have extreme texture issues or only eat things of a certain texture or only eat things of a certain color, avoiding certain foods, complete food groups are being avoided, eliminating foods and then never gaining them back. Nutrient deficiencies absolutely are going to be present here. And here's the thing, a lot of parents will ask me, well, my kid is so picky, they're picky eaters. And I'm someone who really focuses on not over-pathologizing. So what I want to make clear here, when we're talking about ARFID, and we're talking about a diagnostic issue and medical issue here, we have to really take into consideration the amount of impairment and dysfunction that's occurring, right? So we can have picky eaters. I know adults that are still picky eaters. But when we have issues with weight gain and growth, especially with children, we start to see them fall behind on the growth scale, their growth chart, they're starting to decrease. That's when we want to start asking questions, and that's when we want to get involved. That's whenever we can say, this is more than just a picky eater. This is impacting growth and impacting functioning. Lastly, we have what's considered OSFED. OSFED is other specified eating disorder. So that diagnosis would be placed on individuals who may have some criteria of eating disorder, but maybe not fit in that box, right? Which so many of our patients don't. But we also have that as an individual diagnosis for folks who may be struggling along the spectrum and may not fit every single criteria within a diagnosis. So I wanted to share that with you and just start off our presentation with some knowledge about what are these eating disorders, what do they look like. Now we'll move on to Dr. Lutz.
Thank you so much, Dr. Lemke, for explaining it. I know that was a lot of ground to cover in a very short amount of time.
A lot.
I know we're going to get into some of those questions as we go on through the rest of our evening, but we'll circle back on some of that, not to worry. So Dr. Lukes, you, I know, work with parents and families a lot, as well as patients. And I was curious to know, what can parents do and what role do they play? And how can families be supportive and helpful?
I'm so glad you're asking this question. I'm going to pull up my slides too. I think this is such an important question because families and parents play a really important role in supporting treatment and recovery. And there's a lot of things that families can do to help support their loved one when they're seeking treatment for an eating disorder and going through that process of recovery. And it's really important to recognize that family support improves the likelihood of good outcomes for individuals with eating disorders. And there are so many things that families can do. Even in the beginning, learning about treatment options, helping them find treatment, prioritizing treatment. And that's a really big one because, you know, life is very busy, whether the person with an eating disorder, whether they're in school or work. And a lot of the time people may feel like, you know what, even if I want treatment, I have to do all these other things. I can't stop this right now. I can't put this on hold. And families can really help there by, you know, letting their loved one know, this is important. Like, this is your health. It's okay to, you know, it's okay to drop this class right now. It's okay to put this on hold. Your treatment needs to be prioritized just like you would prioritize it for any other health condition. And families can also, you know, they can provide that emotional support, practical, you know, financial support for recovery and treatment. They can really help by validating how difficult recovery is and also expressing confidence that their loved one can recover, especially when their loved one is feeling discouraged. They can work with the treatment team. They can collaborate with their loved one and the treatment team to find, you know, like, what are the specific ways that they can provide support for their loved one that work for them? Because it may be a little different for each person. And so that's really important too, to just to be open to, you know, is this helpful? Like, when we do this, okay, if it's not, what can we try doing that's different instead? And there will be things where it's like, you know what, I know maybe this isn't comfortable. The treatment team's asking us to do this. How can we find a way to do that so that you're comfortable and we're able to provide that support? So having those conversations can be really helpful. And parents and families can also really help, you know, praise that process the person is going through, recognizing recovery. It's not linear. There's a lot of ups and downs, and praising that process the person is going through and not just the outcome. It's really common. People can have a lot of like black and white thinking, and it's like, oh, I didn't do this, or this didn't go the way I wanted. So it's all like a waste, but that's not true. The fact that they're going through it, the fact that they even ran into a bump, a setback, and they're getting back up and they're still going, like, that's something to praise. That's a really positive thing. And so families can really help in a lot of ways by helping people see those positives when they may not be able to. And another important thing for families to know is that, you know, treating eating disorders is really a team effort. So families play an important role in recovery, but it's not something they can do by themselves. Just like if your loved one was dealing with, you know, pneumonia or cancer, you would offer them support, but you would not try to provide all the treatment yourself. You would take them to the doctor. You would go seek out the medical professionals that you need assistance from. And so one metaphor you can use here is this herd of elephants. It's the idea, like, you need the whole herd to support your loved one with an eating disorder. So using your social supports, using the social supports of your loved one, working with the treatment team, working with the physician, the nutritionist, the therapist, you know, everyone to have all of that support. And the treatment team, they can be a real support for the family too, in that the family can like take off some of that pressure, that they don't have to provide all the answers. You know, they don't have to get caught in arguments about, well, this is what, you know, we have to do right now. You can refer to, well, the nutritionist is recommending this. The psychiatrist is recommending this. I read this in a book. I saw this in a talk. So that way you can share that information in a way where you're not getting pulled into maybe like so much a back and forth one-on-one kind of thing. And just real quick, a very brief priority list that can be helpful for families to keep in mind when their loved one has an eating disorder is, first of all, paying attention to medical risk. And that's your first priority. If your loved one needs support for those medical risks, that's where you can say, society expects me to take care of you. Society expects me to keep you safe. And right now we need to take you to the hospital to keep you safe, or we need to make sure you're getting this level of care. So that's the number one priority. The second priority is looking after themselves, because when a family member is exhausted, it's hard to be, you know, to be the most effective caregiver. And that's a hard thing to do. I know families a lot of the time say, I don't want to think about myself. I just want to think about my loved one. And that's wonderful. But taking care of yourself is actually helping to take care of your loved one. And when you do take care of yourself and you do that self-care, you're also role modeling that for your loved one, that it's okay for them to care for themselves too. Another part of this is family members can reflect on how are you responding to the eating disorder? Because it's a very stressful situation to be in. And if the way you're responding is working, you know, keep doing that. That's great. If something isn't working the way you want, maybe try making some changes. Maybe try something different, kind of experiment with it. And after that part too, you can then work with like coaching your loved one, helping to support them to make their own changes, you know, when they're ready and open to that support from you. I wanted to say too, that it's really normal for family members to experience a wide range of emotions when their loved one has an eating disorder, you know, ranging from all these different like gradations of anger and shame and sadness. People often feel very guilty and they may feel embarrassed. A lot of people blame themselves. Families are not to blame for eating disorders. And it's completely normal to have all of these feelings come up. There's nothing wrong with feeling any of these. They're normal reactions to a very stressful situation. And it's important to remember that families often have a lot of hope, optimism. You have that unconditional love. And those are real, you know, real strengths that you're bringing and sharing with your loved one. And a couple things to keep in mind for families that can help with that, that dealing with that stress, because it can be very frustrating when your loved one's dealing with an eating disorder. One thing that can be helpful is this idea of externalizing the illness. So trying to keep the idea of your loved one separate from the eating disorder. And you can try to talk to your loved one, not the illness. Trying to give more attention to the behaviors that you do like, trying to give more attention to things that are going well, and less attention to the behaviors that you don't like. So that can be one tool. Another thing that can help is trying to build empathy for their loved one with the eating disorder. So even though this seems counterintuitive, trying to consider what are the positives of the eating disorder for their loved one? Does it give them a sense of calm or control? Imagining how difficult or scary it must be for them to try and change those eating disorder behaviors. And that can help with that sense of frustration. Again, role modeling self-care, being flexible, just trying to be good enough, not perfect, can all be helpful in supporting their loved one's recovery. And then lastly, I just wanted to put up some resources here that can be helpful for family members, some books that just provide some information about, you know, supporting loved ones and give like really specific suggestions for things you can do. So, and I know we've got a lot of questions, so I'll just stop there.
Thank you so much. It really is, you know, such a team effort. And obviously families and parents, you know, play a really important role in that. Asia, I know there was mention too of the dietitian. And so I was wondering if you could tell us more about the role that a registered dietitian plays in supporting, you know, the children, youth, and families who are dealing either with disordered eating or an eating disorder.
Thanks, Kyle. Yes, I'm going to share my screen in just a second. Sorry, one second. I'm just pulling it up. Okay, you guys should be able to see this now, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so again, my name is Asi and I'm a dietitian, so I'm going to be talking about the role of a dietitian. I hope everybody's doing well and thank you so much for coming here. I'm so excited. This is a really a topic that is so close to my heart. And I enjoy working with clients with this. So first, I'd like you to imagine a beehive and imagine how the beehive has so many honeycombs in it. And so each of these green circles is a honeycomb. So, oops, sorry, one second. Each one of these circles is a honeycomb, and all of these added together provide you with the honey, which would be the health. So the first role of a dietitian would be to do an assessment. Then we educate. After education, we provide nutrition based on whatever education we need to give as we're assessing our client. And then we talk about whatever factors may affect the disordered eating or eating disorder. So we talk about social media, we talk about social eating, we talk about any kind of other diagnoses that a client may have. So whatever other health concerns they may have, poor growth, they may have another anxiety or depression. We may also include fear foods. Fear foods could be from the recent omissions of foods, or they could be from ARFID, what Lacey was talking about, from a diagnosis that avoids certain foods. All of that put together, we give a meal plan, whether it is, I will give a meal plan for clients, whether it's goals or suggestions or something that's a little bit more directive. So a role for a dietitian is to assess a client and give everything in these honeycombs to provide us the best health. There is a lot of factors that impact our children and our teens right now with their current nutrition. There are three environmental factors that I have pinpointed. Of course, this is not a limited list. It's, you keep going on. So the first one that I have listed here is social. And under social, there could be a lot of my clients that I see. This is what I'm listing. So social would be bullying. I see a lot of bullying in the schools, which results to them taking in their internal factors. And they're like, okay, I'm going to start changing my diet. I'm going to start controlling my foods. There may be words that are said to them. So bullying is really a big part of this. Social media, it can't get bigger than that, right? We have 24 hours a day that can be connected to social media or any kind of information that's out there. We have pressures to do better in sports. We have identifying as a smaller, thinner girl. So a client might say, oh, but I was always that thin girl. I was always that small girl. Or that boy might say, I was always a tall, thin, muscular boy, I can't change. So they drive to do a little bit better. And then of course, comparisons because of social media or whatever's happening in school. We do have the family environmental factor, which could be family pressures or the expectation to excel in school, unable to control anything else. So they want to rely on that eating disorder in their environment. There could be inherited behaviors, family history, abuse or trauma. And then of course, there's the medical environmental factors, which could be any diagnoses like anxiety, depression, or failure to grow. But then a big factor could be misinterpretation of what a medical professional has told them. So what do these effects do and how much pressure does it put on one of our child? Well, we could have eating disorders or disordered eating. To me, they're both pretty much the same. I treat them the same. One is, of course, more severe and life-threatening. It is not something you can catch. An eating disorder is not something you just catch by being next to somebody. It's not just a phase where disordered eating is something that's new and temporary and hasn't gone to the potential life-threatening disorder yet. So off to my slide, I have a little circle. It's a cycle pattern, and it shows about dieting and then the mental anguish that a person may go through. So, you know, again, you can have severity of an eating disorder or disordered eating because of these social economic pressures that are out there. We can also have the medical complications, which I know was already touched on. So I'm going to be very brief on this. The one I want to mention the most is that parents really, really know their own kids very well. So if you drop on the growth chart, what that means is, you know, you're born at a certain weight and you're following a certain curve as you grow. If all of a sudden you drop on that curve or you go higher on that curve, we have to take a look at what's happening. Because of course, medical complications of not getting the right nutrition can affect all of your body when you're growing at this age. Can have a lot of behavioral impacts as well. One of them is isolation and depression and anxiety. But the biggest one I want to point out is defiance. You may say, that's not my child. Why are they behaving like this? Why are they all of a sudden upset at dinner time? Or why are they acting this way when we're going to a restaurant? So defiance is a huge piece in this nutrition pattern. So you really want to talk to a dietitian before it advances. So again, like I said, we really know our children really well. So warning signs that I have listed for you is if you're really thinking about how is my child changing or what's happening with my child, you want to look at, has their weight changed, their mood changed? Are they spending a lot of time on social media? Are they looking up research? So try to take their phone and see what kind of history they're going through to see, are they spending a lot of time looking up, a calorie king, or are they looking up videos on what a person eats throughout the day? You may notice also at home, like I said, the restaurants become harder. They are disappearing at mealtime, or they're saying they don't feel good, or they're not hungry anymore. Or all of a sudden your meals are changing where they're watching how you're preparing your foods, or they are interested in grocery shopping and they want cleaner foods or healthier foods. You may also notice them to not consume the same foods that they normally consume, or they just don't feel good. So those are just a few warning signs, but as a parent, you really know your child. So try to go through this. And if you see this is already happening along with everything else that we've all touched on, you really want to reach out to somebody. And then that's the role of a dietitian. And then as you meet with the dietitian like myself, you'll get consistent eating patterns. You'll learn how for your child to eat socially again, stabilize your weight, whether it's up or down, and then integrate them back into society with that team approach. I know that we have more questions, so I hope that this was helpful.
Thank you so much. Well, thank you to all of you. I mean, that information is so helpful. And it also really, I think, sets the stage for our questions that were submitted prior to tonight's event. So we'll get started with those. There are a lot of them. They cover a lot of ground. So a lot of the questions that were submitted were focused on adolescents. So kids in middle school, high school, and even college. I'd like to begin, though, with a question from the mom of a younger child that I think represents a concern that many parents have. And she asked, I have a 2-year-old that refuses to eat. Everyone tells me that it's a stage. How can I know if it's a stage or if he needs help? Now, I know, Dr. Lemke, that you touched on this, but maybe you could tell us a little bit more. I know I had a very picky eater. So I think, you know, the question really is, how do we as parents know when our child's eating habits are just a stage or something more? And what advice would you have? You know, this is a 2-year-old. So I think that, you know, that question is a little different, obviously, than if it was a slightly older child.
Right. Absolutely. So especially for our younger babes that are just struggling and decide, oh, well, I don't want this, I don't want that. I think the biggest piece of advice that I would give a parent is, one, really pay attention to what's going on. Is it a particular food group? Is it a particular texture that you're noticing? Is the child eating anything at all? Which clearly that's what you would hope, right? What is the child eating? What does the child indicate is the problem, right? And then next, I would always advise a pediatrician visit, right? Collaborate with the pediatrician to see, is my child growing appropriately? Is this something common, right? And discuss it with your pediatrician. As I said before, I think people have different philosophies on this, but I am very restrictive in my pathology. I don't like to just slap a diagnosis on kids, adolescents, or adults. So I think we have to really watch out because some things can be normalized. Some things are phases, right? Especially with our little ones when it comes to things that they like and don't like. So I would definitely advise paying very close attention. Are there any patterns that you're seeing, and collaborating with the pediatrician? And if the pediatrician is saying, you know what, growth is being a little bit impacted, then you want to seek some intervention. Maybe partner with a dietitian, partner with a pediatric therapist who can engage the child in some exposure-based treatment and so forth. So, yeah.
That's great advice. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Christina, I want to bring you into this conversation now. So we had a mom who asked, my son says he's not hungry at all and refuses to eat. Now, we don't know how old the child is, so I will preface that. He has lost weight, but gained a little height. And as his parents were concerned due to the signs of unhealthy conditions that are showing up in his nails, his hair, et cetera, what should we do?
Great question. And there's been a lot of fantastic information that I'm going to pull into this that's already been shared. First, I think it takes a lot of vulnerability to share a concern like that about your son, and it can feel scary. So just being able to speak up and ask that question really shows a lot of strength and power there. And I would encourage you to reach out to the pediatrician with those concerns. It's great that we're still growing, but there is something in your gut that is saying something feels off right now, and you're seeing the resistance from your son of saying he's not hungry. So first I would, encourage you to speak with your pediatrician about those concerns. I would encourage you to build out a team to support both you and the family. You know, it's been shared before that the sooner that we pile in the support, the more we take off the weight of you as a parent of having to play all the different roles of understanding what might be going on, and the greater the outcome can be. In terms of suppressed hunger or saying I'm not hungry, there's a lot of different factors that can be playing a role there. There can be fears that are developing around the food. So there's an emotional, there could be a mental piece going on. There could also be a physical piece going on. The more we restrict, the more we consciously and unconsciously start to suppress our hunger cues. So he might not be recognizing what hunger feels like anymore. And then physically, he could also be having what we call slow gut motility, that when we've been in a period of restriction, our gut isn't working at the same speed that it normally is. And so we can get fuller a lot quicker and not get the amount of food that the body actually needs for growth, even though we feel full. So there's a lot of different factors that can be at play, which is why it's great to follow what your gut is telling you and reach out to the pediatrician as your first area of communication. And then in the meantime, Melissa talked about some of the role of family and building that empathy. I would encourage you in the meantime to think about, I love the phrase that two things can be true, is that right now for your son, this is feeling, eating feels hard, it feels scary, there's a lot of emotions that are going on, and it's also true that his body still likely needs more food. So sort of thinking about that as a piece, but I would really encourage you to reach out to your pediatrician.
Thank you. It strikes me, I am a big believer in listening to your gut. So I have older kids, I am a huge believer in listening to your sort of mom and dad instinct. And, it seems like it's a reoccurring theme in everything that everybody I think is saying is, as parents, we kind of know when something doesn't feel quite right. And sometimes we sort of push that down, but really kind of tapping into that you know your child best. Nobody knows your child better than you do. And, really learning to listen to that and kind of make sure that you follow that when there's a little buzzer going off for you, pay attention. So disordered eating impacts kids on both sides of the continuum. So some are concerns about not eating, which we just talked about, and sometimes there are concerns about overeating. So another question that was submitted that we were asked about was, my 11-year-old daughter tends to overeat and sneak food, which has led to a BMI in the 99th percentile. We've talked about it so many times with focus on maintaining a healthy body. I've tried rewards and punishment, but nothing seems to stick. I don't want to micromanage her eating, but as soon as I loosen up, she takes advantage. She says she doesn't care, and I don't know how to get her to care so that she can develop healthier habits while she's still young, so this doesn't become a lifelong issue. How can I help her? Asia, what advice would you have for this parent?
Thanks, Kyle. So I think the biggest part of this statement is that she doesn't care. So I think as a parent, we have to look at, why doesn't she care? What's going on with her where she's feeling this self of not caring? And then what's coming on in her head? What's happening where she's wanting to overeat? So sometimes it's taking a look at, honey, what's wrong? Is there something happening? Is there something we need to talk about? So sometimes there's outside factors that are happening. And so when she's at a safe place like home, she feels like she needs to relate to food or to give her something. So I've noticed this in my practice where usually there's an outside factor that's leading to her not feeling like she should care. And then what's happening where she's turning to something that's easy for her. Because remember, food can be a coping skill, not always the best coping skill, but again, food can be a coping skill. So for this parent, what I would recommend is seeing, can you look at her diet? Can you see, is she getting meals through the day? Is she not eating at school because something's happening? Is she getting her full breakfast in? Because remember, like, she may get all her nutrition in just in the evening time. So we really have to take a look at, what times is she eating? So as a mom, just, or dad, you know, really trying to plug in, trying to pay attention to those cues. Did I give her breakfast and she eat it? Honey, what did you have for lunch today? Or looking at her meal card to see, is she spending the money at lunch? And then also, you know, if there's no answers there, I would suggest talking to a dietitian without the child. So like, I know I talk to clients all the time or parents all the time, so I can give them advice like changing the plate size without her knowing, or finding different types of snacks that may have a little bit more fiber in there, a little bit more protein, to give them a sense of fullness. So that way they're coming home and having those snacks that they need. So the hiding and the sneaking foods, again, can be addressed by letting them know, what is it that you would like? Can I offer you this at this time? So they don't feel more ashamed by hiding the foods and then you finding them.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. I hope that helps. I mean, we don't have very much time, so I'm trying to give you as much, give everybody as much information as I can.
To piggyback off of that, just to chime in, I think one thing that's very important to remember with eating disorders is that it has nothing to do with the food, right? And so I think that's one thing, and Asya spoke to this a little bit, as a parent, really viewing it has nothing to do with the food, understanding that, and understanding that we have to, as professionals, as supports, understand what is the function of that behavior, right? So is this child using food as a soother? As Asya said, is this a way that the child is coping with something? So understanding that function can go a long way. And sometimes that's hard for parents to be able to do because you're mom and dad, right? So even using the help of a support, like a therapist that specializes in eating disorders, to understand that for the patient can really help in collaboration with the dietitian, get that child on a more balanced track and using healthier behaviors instead of utilizing food.
I'm gonna share one more thought just to kind of pull it all, you know, pull in one more piece of this that, you know, sometimes we can, as parents, we have this desire to help mold our children into a healthy lifestyle. And when we're told by a physician that our child is gaining too much weight, we can feel the desire to begin to control their food and control their portions and serve what we feel like are the healthiest options. And I do encourage parents to try to avoid that language of healthy versus not healthy, because it can stigmatize the food. And something that I love to encourage parents on is thinking about, when we think about our types of hunger, you know, Asya touched on that physiological hunger of making sure they're well fed, the emotional hunger of that coping mechanism, but really honing in on that taste hunger and thinking about foods that also we just really enjoy eating and that satisfy that taste hunger so that we aren't grabbing those foods when they are finally given to us and we're given permission. And then we can tend to go overboard because we don't know when that food's going to be provided to us again. So really sort of bringing in what those taste flavors that your children are enjoying and really incorporating different treats in there, and not overly trying to control or restrict or, you know, put those foods that you feel like are going to fix that, that weight and make that, you know, in going down that spectrum. So kind of putting all those pieces together.
Thank you. All right, we are going to move on to a slightly different topic now. We had a number of questions that were submitted about body image. So one mom asked, my 7-year-old daughter is having body image issues. We only talk about positive body image at home, and she has no access to social media. What steps can I take at home at this early age to steer her in the right direction? Another parent asked, what can parents do to counter the influence of diet culture, which is everywhere, sometimes even in medical offices? Dr. Lusk, I was wondering, do you have suggestions for how parents can help support and foster healthy body image? And I'd actually like to roll into that a little bit more of another part of the question, because I'm looking in our chat and one of the questions came in has to do with, again, you know, questions about social media, which is obviously kind of a part of this conversation too. And what it says, anyone, can you address how to eliminate exposure to social media, which has, you know, such an impact on their daughter's disorder or son's disorder? So I'm going to roll all of that, I think, into one kind of question and hand it over to you, Melissa.
Okay. Well, those are great questions and super relevant, especially with everything going on in the news with, you know, Facebook and Instagram and all of that. And actually, I pulled up a couple of resources from NEDA, the National Eating Disorder Association website. So I'm going to share my screen again, just to share those two. But, you know, some of the things that, the first mom was talking about that she's doing are great. I mean, trying to promote that positive body image, you know, especially for a 7-year-old, limiting social media access when there's so much out there, especially a lot of negative stuff. And so just some other things in general that we can do. One is recognizing that we're in like a really difficult place when it comes to body image. Like we really are in a society where unfortunately there are a lot of negative messages just being put out there about body image from all, you know, all places. And so trying, you know, when possible, like if there's an opportunity, if your kid mentions something like that, maybe trying to be curious, kind of asking them, you know, just like really open-ended questions, trying to explore with them, you know, like what is it that they're thinking? Like, where is that coming from for them? Just so you get a better understanding of like, where are those ideas coming from? What does it mean to them? And letting them express that. And also like when they do express that, really encouraging, you know, encouraging just the fact that they were willing to share that with you, even if it's something that is negative, like, and not something you want to hear from them, or is it not something you'd want for them? Just encouraging the fact that they're willing to be open and honest about it is really important. And then in terms of like just developing and modeling healthy body image, some of the things like other people have been talking about too, kind of trying to set a positive example in terms of like a healthy and balanced relationship with food. And by that, I mean like kind of viewing food as fuel and not actually viewing food as either good or bad or healthy or unhealthy. Like people were saying, helping your child, like, you know, accept and appreciate their body, trying to encourage their self-esteem. Again, encouraging them to be open about what they're thinking and feeling and reacting to things, trying to encourage them to think critically about social media. Like, okay, like, so what is going on with that ad? Why are they trying to tell us we need to look thinner or this or that or whatever it is? Are they, you know, are they making money off of that? Even kind of, you know, helping them to be, you know, more critical consumers of that media. And also trying to promote, you know, like values about people based off of, you know, internal things that are important to you, not just like the external or the appearance base, but even like the function of our body. And one idea that can be really helpful with that too is this idea of body neutrality. So people hear a lot about body positivity, which is awesome, you know, but sometimes that's hard. Sometimes we don't feel like we can go from, oh, I hate this part of my body to I love it. So it can be helpful to use body neutrality. There is kind of a nice in between, and body neutrality it's not about it's not about having to love the way your body looks. Instead, it's celebrating what your body can do and recognizing, you know, those parts of our body, like just what they do for us beyond appearance. And so ways we can practice that and kind of help model that for our kids and encourage it for them, trying to practice gratitude for the things our body can do, trying to combat that negative self-talk with, you know, body neutral responses. So if we have the thought, oh, like, I hate how my thighs look, well, you know, my thighs are getting me from point A to point B, you know, they're strong, they're carrying me around. You know, trying to change our approach with food and exercise. If we find that we are eating or exercising to lose weight or to maintain a certain shape, can we eat and exercise in a way that's focused on promoting like joy in our life or promoting, you know, health that's not based off of a number or appearance? And then like decluttering social media feeds or magazines or whatever it is that's promoting like that diet culture. And I think that's a, you know, the social media piece is very tricky, especially, you know, with older kids where they have more independence, and some of it may be, you know, trying to keep those open, you know, lines of communication with them. How are you feeling after you look at this stuff? And sometimes, like they were saying with all the stuff with Facebook, sometimes people know that it's making them feel bad and they can't stop looking at it. So maybe trying to talk about, you know, what can we do to support you with this? Are there limits that we need to put on it? Kind of, which is a tricky space to navigate. But so these are just some resources. And also Nita has a nice post too on like 10 steps to improve body image. And so this could be something to look at kind of for, you know, for parents to use for themselves as a way of modeling it, things that you might be able to use with your kids too, in terms of trying to help encourage, you know, that, you know, healthy body image. But great questions, very tricky to navigate.
I really like that notion of body neutrality. I've never heard that before. And I think that's really, really interesting. To follow up on that question, how can other adults like teachers or school staff support kids at school who say that they're too fat or too skinny? And what are some ways to support students who are being bullied by peers due to body shape or size? Dr. Lemke, I was wondering what kind of advice you would have for school staff. I'm a former teacher, and I certainly know, you know, we spend a lot of time with our kids in our classrooms and, you know, want to be equipped to be able to handle those kinds of situations to do what's, you know, best to support our students.
Absolutely. I think first and foremost, when I hear anything about bullying at all, I think the number one thing is to advocate for continued policies and procedures in the school, right? To minimize that as much as possible. But we can't get rid of it all, right? But I do think that's the first go-to. Second off, my biggest piece of advice to anyone in schools, because you do, as you were saying, Kyle, you spend so much time with the kids, is pay attention and don't stop paying attention. I think really working to validate individuals as they come to you or students as they're struggling, validate their concerns. Focusing on empowerment and increasing self-esteem, utilizing social workers, utilizing counselors, and just continuing to pay attention and to speak up. So often I work with patients at our hospital who have talked about seeking out support at school and it going really well in the beginning, and then it kind of falls off the radar. We can't let it fall off the radar. And so I think it takes a village. I don't think that it's any one person's responsibility at a school to take care of a student, right? It takes a village. So incorporating all of the other supports, communicating about what's going on within the school, and then again, keeping that attention and keeping, checking in on that student, asking if there's anything that they need, right? Again, setting them up with supports. I think that's the biggest thing that we can do. When kids have the opportunity to feel supported and loved, and they have the opportunity to start opening up about these things, we start to see some really interesting things happen, especially in our program. When we have our patients come in and they start finally disclosing some things and feeling open to talk about it, we really truly start to see a shift. We start to see behaviors start to decrease a bit because they're starting to let out so much of the distress that they've been bottling. It's a very long-winded answer, but that's what I got.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yes. Oh, so as a parent in Barrington, G20, we have SEL. And so in the middle schools, I know that they do a lot of SEL talks. So the counselors can go in and do a piece. So if a parent is struggling and they know that their child has been bullied or comments have been said, or they feel like their child is being pinpointed towards a weight comment, you can easily call or send an email to the counselors and ask, is there any way can we add an SEL piece in about bullying again for this group, for the sixth graders? You know, at Station Middle School, I know that you can easily get the sixth grader, seventh grade, or eighth grade counselors in and let them know what's happening. Because again, it does take a village, like Lacey said, like all of us has said, takes a village. So if I am a parent and I hear from my son's friend, then that's something I can do as well. So keeping our eyes out and ears out, I think is really important, but asking for that piece could be helpful.
Thank you. I think another piece that I would like to mention, I think it's appropriate in kind of this setting at the moment, is, you know, I've been having a number of conversations with staff, both at Barrington High School and with the middle schools. And one of the things that we are working right now is there are definitely staff members who are interested in learning more about disordered eating, eating disorders, how to support our students in our district. And so we're in the process of having some conversations about creating, you know, potentially some lunch and learns with this amazing, fabulous team of experts to come in and have some conversations with staff. And so that is something that, you know, we're working and having discussions with the school to have these conversations to equip the teachers in a different way, maybe. Again, we've been having these conversations about, you know, trigger words and things like that. And again, I'm going to put my teacher hat on. We would never intentionally, good teachers, I should say, would never intentionally do anything to harm their students. And, you know, we really care deeply about our kids and want to learn, you know, and be more aware. And sometimes I think that teachers just aren't necessarily aware of what's, you know, what impact they're having in some of the language that they use, perhaps, or in a way a lesson is structured. Or so these are conversations that, you know, I think, you know, we'll continue to try to push. Obviously, Be Strong Together is a separate entity from the district, but we work closely with them, and we'll continue to try to engage them in these conversations in the hopes of maybe bringing about a different level of awareness. And the team that's here tonight has been so gracious to offer to come in and have some of those conversations. So I just want people to know it is definitely something that's on the radar, and we'll continue to work toward. So I know, Christina, that one of your specialties is in sports, and you yourself, I know, are a runner. And so when this question came in, I thought this was the perfect question for Christina. So somebody asked the question, when is it safe to go back to running? My daughter runs cross country. How common are eating disorders with runners?
Yes. So in my practice, I do work with a lot of student athletes and non-athletes alike, but I am a runner and runners are my jam. So number one, I would absolutely refer to your child's support team because they know your child best. So that is who I would ask these questions to. But in generality, when your daughter is in this stage of recovery, that's amazing to begin with. And a couple of the factors that we're going to be considering is, first, we need to have medical clearance. So when we're thinking medical stability, you're going to be having appointments with your physician. They're going to be assessing a variety of factors. The doctor is going to be looking at weight. They're going to be looking at vital signs, so pulse and blood pressure, body temperature. We're going to be checking lab values and making sure that there's normal blood work going on. Because the question was about a daughter, I work with a lot of the hypothalamic amenorrheas, that loss of period, which is unfortunately very common in runners, but we shouldn't be normalizing it in runners. And so if there is period loss, where it's considered to be a recovered period when we've had three consecutive cycles in a row that are of normal length and span. So when that comes on, ideally we're returning to running in an off season where we can also start to retrain the body with a lower heart rate training that puts a lot less stress on the body. So that would be some of the medical stability parts that the physician would be assessing. From the nutrition standpoint, if we're considering going back to running, I'm going to make the assumption that the recovery piece in the nutrition and the repair of any kind of starvation and malnutrition has been taking place. And now we want to make sure that your daughter is in a place where they are going to also be able to support the extra exertion that is going to be happening running. We don't want to set it up in a stage where it's a burn to earn mentality. So we do need to be mindful of how we present that and discuss it. So it's not, we eat more food because we're burning calories, but it's more in a supportive manner. So, are they ready to be adding in different parts of pre-run fueling, post-run fueling for recovery, really feeling comfortable with increasing their carb intake as a runner? So those are some of the nutritional components you want to be thinking about when you're returning to running. And then we want to always be thinking about that emotional and the mental considerations. Melissa touched on it as she was talking about that body image piece. And it is really important because we want to be assessing what the relationship with running is. And I do tend to see a lot of runners that in their recovery, they realize that running wasn't necessarily a positive place for their recovery to be, and they might not want to return to running right away. So we do want to give them that safe space to explore, do they want to return to running on a competitive team? Do they want to explore it maybe as a stress relieving activity that isn't as competitive, and giving them that space to explore what their relationship to running looks like now. And if they do want to return, you know, what does that relationship with rest days look like? Watching for signs of compulsiveness as they return to running. And so there's a lot of different components at play, which again, bring your support team into this because everybody can help really help that recovery strong as we're returning to running. I think that when we think about the prevalence of eating disorders or disordered eating in runners and in endurance sports or in any sport where an athlete, there may be added pressure on the body shape and size. You know, in the running community, there's been an unfortunate, which we are seeing a big shift, especially in female runners and being more vocal about this. There's been a culture of to be lighter on my feet and lighter equating to weighing less. And we can often see a diminishing return when you start to lose weight as a runner and your performance starts to suffer. So I think one, there's a kind of a running culture pressure on disordered eating behaviors. Number two, you know, the idea that for a long time it's been normalized that missing a period is just an acceptable thing as a female runner, and recognizing that that's a really early warning sign that there is stress and injury happening in the body. So helping to break through that. And then also I think some of the prevalence within the running community is what drew you to running in the first place? And did you get drawn to running because it was a means of trying to control your body and your weight? So when we think about the prevalence being high in the running community, I think there's a lot of different factors at play too. So those would be some of the different components I'd encourage you to think about as your daughter's considering to go back to running, but of course, you know, defer always to your pediatrician and your support team.
Thank you. It seems like a lot of that too could apply to a lot of different athletes, not just runners. So
100%.
The question is about runners. It seems to me that a lot of what you just shared, you know, is something that would apply to a lot of different athletes.
Absolutely.
So now we've talked about little kids. We've talked about, you know, kind of kids up into high school. And we did receive a question for college. So I did want to ask that question. So a mom asked, for college age girls, being very thin and eliminating certain foods has become so common and normal. It's difficult for them to see that this can be problematic. So it's difficult for them to embrace change. Do you have tips for how to have a conversation about disordered eating or an eating disorder and continue to have it when your daughter doesn't see it as a problem or something potentially harmful down the road? What guidance would you have for our family system to be in this together in truth and love? So I am the parent of a college student. And one of the things I also know about this question that I'm reading into it is that a lot of times our college age students are over the age of 18, which does also complicate, you know, things a little bit in that those conversations are really critical because this is not taking your child to the pediatrician. This is, there's a level of agreement that is required of someone who is no longer a minor in a different way than maybe, you know, say for much younger children. So Asia, I was wondering what advice you might have for this mom.
Well, I definitely have advice. I want to take the second part where you said they're 18, they're not a minor anymore. You can't really take them into a pediatrician. I think where I want to start is that part of the question. What I would recommend is seeing what have you heard? What is the information that you've gotten? Where did it come from? And seeing if you can provide some insight. If, again, as a parent, it's not always taken 100%. So that's where you can reach out to one of us professionals and say, okay, you know what, Asya, can you just go back and forth on the myths and see what that person has in their head? I think just having dialogue with a professional that's an expert in that field is extremely important. So asking, you know, like having that child or that teen write down all the information that they've heard or come in with some ideas of what they want to talk about and just have a session of just talking to bust the myths. Another thing is asking, why is there like so much pressure on that person? Is it because of social media? Can you, like, again, like Melissa was talking, change the feed? Can you see what their thoughts and ideas are? Can you go to lunch and say, oh, let's have a burger and see what they say? And then be able to respond to them like, well, nutrients fit. So, you know, you can always call a professional as well and just throw some ideas back and forth before meeting with your child or your teen or even your college age kid to see how can I address that. There's a lot of misinformation out there, unfortunately, but most of it is finding out the root.
Thank you.
I know we're over time. I just want to say one thing about this. If the person who submitted this question called my voicemail and left me a message, I am so sorry that I took down. Sorry, this is so unprofessional, but I'm doing it because I may not get to talk to this person. I took down your number. I deleted my voicemail and emptied my box. And then I don't know where the post-it is. So if this is you and you called me, I didn't forget about you. And I think about you very often. Please call me back. But also, just really quick, I think, you know, in the therapy world, we talk a lot about motivational interviewing, and that can really come in helpful with college age students who are like, mom, I don't have a problem, leave me alone, I'm fine, right? But you're noticing weights dropping. I think having a conversation about their goals, you're wanting to do X, Y, and Z after college, do you think you're going to be able to do that and live on your own and be successful if you can't take care of yourself, right? So having some of those honest conversations. But I just, a mom called me. This sounds very familiar. And call me back.
Not to worry. I actually know who the person is who asked the question. Okay. And I will make sure that they call you back.
I think about this person. So I'm like, oh my God, I never not call people back. So, okay.
Okay. So We are a little over time, so we're going to wrap up. But before we end this evening, I would like to introduce you to somebody who is special to me, and who really, really, really helped us put this evening together. And her name is Renee Bach. And Renee is an outreach liaison for Amita Behavioral Health, working with the Center for Eating Disorders. So she's someone you all know. She's also a fabulous volunteer with Be Strong Together. So again, I am so appreciative of all of her support and her help putting this program together. But the reason I'm actually going to ask her to introduce herself is because Renee is an amazing, amazing resource for so many people who are looking for help. And so Renee, I would like you, if you don't mind, to tell us a little bit about, just quickly, about what your job and how you can help families who are concerned about eating disorders or disordered eating in our community.
Of course. Thank you, Kyle, for all of the kind words. In my role as a liaison with Amita's programs, I work with our higher level of carers, and I get to collaborate with our wonderful clinical team. So I have a lot of support, as you've seen tonight. But I talk to providers. So I have a very good knowledge base of all of the treatment opportunities that are in the market in terms of different levels of care, whether you need a dietitian, a therapist, a psychiatrist, maybe to get aligned with a primary care doctor who understands eating disorders and can help you support that way. But as you heard, eating disorders are so complex. So in my role, I'm working both with those providers, and I have a pretty good knowledge base of those, as well as working with families. So anyone can reach out to me at any time. I know I'm on the resource sheet that Kyle put together. The most important thing I'd love to do, whether it's with one of our programs or outside of our programs, is make sure if you're in need of connecting yourself or someone to treatment, that I'm able to get you in touch with someone who's specialized. And I think that's the most important thing with eating disorders. It truly is a specialized need for treatment, and you would like to be connected to someone. And it can be very challenging to navigate that along with everything that's going on in life. So look for my contact. And if you need any information, please reach out.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. With that, I want to give a super thank you to all of our amazing experts for all of their help tonight. Our talk, as I said, has been recorded. So I will process the recording as soon as we're done tonight, and I will make sure to get it up on the Be Strong Together website either later this evening or certainly by tomorrow morning. Our website is the letter B and then strong together. So no E. So bestrongtogether.org. I've also created a web page on our website that is dedicated to eating disorders and disordered eating. And it has lots of information, including, as Renee made mention, I put together a resource handout that will be on that page as well, that has Renee's contact information, Christina's contact information. How to get in touch with Amita. And I think, did I forget anybody? Who am I forgetting? Asia, I've got your information on there. So that if you're looking for some support and some help, it has lots of great information, as well as national organization contact information for that. So I will put that up there as well. And you can find the video link will be on our webpage as along with that. I will also be sending out an email to anybody who registered for tonight's program with all the links and the video and the handout and everything. It will be sent to you directly tonight. So thank you again to everyone. And thank you to our experts for their time and sharing their expertise. And we hope that people found it helpful. So have a nice evening, everybody.
Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you so much.